For the week of January 29th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 134, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in St. Petersburg, Florida, I'm Michael Giltz.
I'm not even going to ask what you're doing in St. Petersburg, Florida. Last week it was, what, Alabama or Mississippi somewhere, and now you're in St. Petersburg, Florida.
That's right. I'm visiting family and friends. In fact, my mom listens to our podcast now. I showed her how to do it on her iPad. So she's very excited. She's been catching up on old episodes. She says she really likes you, Sperling.
Ooh.
She doesn't know this, but I've lied to her about where I am. She thinks I've gone back up north to New York. But in fact, I went to visit some friends, and I'm coming back to Alabama for her birthday on Wednesday, February 2nd. So hopefully she won't listen to the podcast Wednesday, February 1st, tomorrow. So hopefully she won't hear the download of the podcast until I've appeared to wish her a happy birthday tomorrow. So that'll be a fun surprise.
Well, when she does listen to the podcast, what she's going to find out, of course, is all about the latest awards being given out by the DGA, PGA, SAG, and any other three- or four-letter organization that hands out awards to movies and television shows. We'll also be joined by Michael Tuckman from M. Tuckman Media, and he's going to he's kind of a distribution expert, a movie distribution expert, and he's going to be joining us to talk about this past year's Sundance Film Festival, which came to an end on Sunday, and some awards were handed out there to some of the top films. We'll also be talking about the state of the music industry and how global digital music sales are actually up, not down, and we'll talk about some Spotify and Pandora news as well. Michael, you've got some theater news for us, specifically some news about the Book of Mormon and what's going on with that show, and we'll cover all the big entertainment news and big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world this weekend is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. It grossed $28 million. It is now at $572 million worldwide. It's officially the highest grossing Mission Impossible film in the franchise yet. So you can bet your bottom dollar there'll be another one coming along before you know it.
Pretty amazing, don't you think? I mean, the movie was released in December. It's the end of January now. But the fact that it wasn't released everywhere in mid-December means that now that it's hitting all of these international markets, it's still doing quite well.
Well, it's not amazing, but I mean, you do see movies that open worldwide on the same day. I'm sure Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit will do that. But even a big movie like Mission Impossible, it's pre-sold. There are still issues you want to take with, like, holidays and this, especially around the December holiday season. It's a very different market in every part of the world. So you want to have open this week here, that week there. It's all been within 4 or 5 weeks. So it's not like they're opening it up 6 months later in Timbuktu. But, it's been 4 or 5 weeks and it's been almost everywhere around the world. It's already played out, but still making $28 million. And it's already the top grossing Mission Impossible film of all time. At number two around the world is The Gray, starring Liam Neeson, action hero. It grossed $23 million worldwide. Most of that was made in North America, where it was also the number one film, but it has started to open up overseas. And that's a big success story for Open Road Films.
Yes, this is the distributor that was created by AMC Entertainment and Regal Entertainment, which, if you're trying to think, okay, what other movies have they released? You'd be hard-pressed, because they're actually movie theater companies. They're the two largest movie theater companies in the world, mind you, located here in North America. But they teamed up and created Open Road Films, which is this joint venture to distribute independent films in a way. And in this case, it happens to be a pretty high budget, $25 million independent film, but they only paid $5 million for the rights to release it in North America. So they're doing quite well. They made $20 million in the U.S. and Canada this week.
And it's they felt the word that studios weren't going to give them proper movies, or they needed more access to material for their theaters. That was the reason they formed.
Yes, that was absolutely right. Yes, they were saying, well, look, if the distributors are going to start releasing films day and date on VOD and be releasing shrinking the windows, we have to have the right to go out and source our own product.
Oh, that's right. Exactly. So it's an amazing thing. And guess what? I guess Monopoly, all those antitrust issues are out the window.
That's right. Yeah. The Paramount decree, which was basically when the studios had to divest themselves of the movie theaters that they own, because studios owned most of the movie theaters, or at least the big profitable ones. In 1948, that came down, and all of a sudden, all of these studios had to sell their movie theaters. Well, now it's the other way around. Now movie theaters are actually becoming studios. So go figure.
So The Gray is a very significant film in the history of theaters and studios and theatrical distribution. It'll always be a good footnote as far as, you know, this coming back into play. Number three around the world is also an interesting movie. It's The Descendants, starring George Clooney. It grossed $22 million worldwide. It's at $86 million and counting. Its entire budget was about $20 million. We're not quite sure about that, but that seems to be the rough budget. The Oscar nominations came out about 10 days ago. People always want to position their movie to benefit as much as possible from Oscar nominations if it's that type of movie. Every year you'll find maybe at least one or two movies that does a really good job of platforming off that attention and increasing their box office a lot. The Descendants has done that to a T. It's made about $50 million in the U.S. already, or $60 million. So we're talking about overseas where it's opening wide. In the U.S., it just made another $6 million, which is a lot for this movie. It did expand a number of screens. It grossed $6.5 million in the U.S. That's a good amount of money for this type of film. But overseas, it made another $16 million. That's a lot for this quiet little drama. And it's turning this into a really big success story. At number four around the world is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, another $20 million worldwide. That's at $469 million and counting. At number five is the werewolf versus vampire movie Underworld Awakening, which grossed another $18 million. That's at $85 million worldwide. At number six is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. That made another $13 million worldwide. That's $185 million and counting. They're still hoping to try and turn this into not a big loss, but I don't think they're going to make it. At number seven is One for the Money. That's a debut. That's a Katherine Heigl film. It's a potential franchise, though not with this money, based on a book by Janet Ivanovich about a bounty hunter. There's a series of them. It grossed $11 million in North America alone, basically. Right after that is Red Tails, the George Lucas film about World War II fighter pilots, African-Americans fighting for their country. It grossed $10 million. Is that $33 million and counting? Right after that is Man on a Ledge, another debut film. So not a great week for a lot of new movies. The Gray was the real big success. This is a movie starring Sam Worthington and Jamie Bell, and it made $8 million. Behind that is Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked, another $8 million. That's at $310 million worldwide and counting. And then another movie that's doing a good job of bouncing off of its Oscar nomination for Best Picture. That's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which made another $7.1 million. It's at $21 million worldwide and counting.
Well, now Max von Sydow was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, and the film got Best Picture nomination as well.
Right. Now, I haven't seen Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. I finally caught up with the final cut of The Warrior. I had seen a previous cut, and I have to say, last week you asked me who I would take out of the Best Supporting Actor nominees to put in Albert mm-hmm. Brooks. It would be Nick Nolte for The Warrior. I mean,
thought it was just a familiar, drunken old, broken down old man.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, he didn't do a bad job by any stretch. I mean, he did a good job, but not better than Albert Brooks.
Well, there you go. It's always a hard, you know, apples and oranges. It's a hard thing to do, but Nick Nolte's often been an Oscar favorite. So I'm not surprised to see that. So we talked about Incredibly Loud and The Descendants making a good bounce from Oscar nominations. Let's look at a couple of other movies very quickly. The Artist, of course, is the big winner in the Oscar nominations. It's doing terrifically well. And how's it doing at the box office? It grossed another $5 million roughly worldwide. It's at $41 million and counting, which is tremendous for a black and white silent film. But they want to do a lot better if they want to keep that momentum going towards winning the Best Picture. War Horse grossed $6 million worldwide. It's at $111 million and counting. There's not a whole lot of countries left to play out, and it can't be considered anything but a disappointment. Spielberg's other film, The Adventures of Tintin, it's almost done now. It's at $272 million worldwide. Again, that's a very poor showing for a movie of this cost and this potential. That's just not a good story. The Tree of Life has done great overseas. It grossed $13 million in the U.S., but almost $50 million around the world. So that's been a big success. And Woody Allen, of course, has Midnight in Paris. That's basically done worldwide. That's his biggest hit ever in North America, if you don't adjust for inflation, at $56 million. And he's made another $100 million overseas. So he's at about $150 million worldwide. That's a tremendous showing. Martin Scorsese was hoping for a bigger bounce from the Oscar nominations. Hugo has grossed $58 million domestically and $30 million overseas. So that's about $88 million worldwide on a budget of $150 million and a very big ad campaign. But it shouldn't be a surprise because Martin Scorsese has never made a movie that grossed $150 million in the U.S. after decades of work. So why you'd suddenly give him $150 million to make a movie is beyond me.
Well, that's a good point.
I do want to make one final point. I'm not sure if the movie A Better Life played at Sundance, but I have never seen it. It is not a foreign film. It is an independent film by Chris White. of American Pie.
Chris White's, yeah, okay.
American Pie. It's about a gardener in East LA who struggles to protect his son from gangs and from immigration authorities because they're there illegally, I guess. It's a good film. I know people who've seen it. And the lead actor got a Best Actor nomination, a terrifically welcome surprise for him and the film, which deserves more attention. I look forward to seeing it, and I improperly identified it as a foreign film. It's not. It's just a movie I haven't seen yet. But congrats to them on that Oscar nomination. I look forward to catching it up on DVD.
Well, now, I don't think that A Better Life, directed by Chris Weitz, premiered at Sundance last year or in previous years. But, you know, some movies that might be discussed in our box office segment in the future, as well as potentially even our awards news, are the movies that premiered at this past year's Sundance Film Festival, which came to a close on Sunday. Joining us to discuss this past year's festival is Michael Tuckman from M. Tuckman Media. Michael, thank you for joining us. And I'm a little confused. What does M. Tuckman Media do exactly?
That's a good question. Well, my history, I worked as vice president of theatrical sales for Think Film for 7 years until that company ran its course. and now what I do is I take services I provided there and give that to smaller distributors who might not have a full-time salesperson. So I handle the theatrical booking for distributors, including Tribeca Film, Paladin, Entertainment One, and also for independent producers like Fred Weissman. I'm releasing his current film, Crazy Horse, which actually opens at the New Art this Friday in Los Angeles. And I also program select regional film festivals. More of the spotlight titles, the larger titles that will play at festivals in places including San Jose, Sarasota, Vermont, Scottsdale, kind of everything. So when I'm at Sundance, I really have a roving eye for a million things going on while I'm there.
Well, Crazy Horse is the Frederick Weissman documentary about the Crazy Horse Saloon. I'm looking forward to seeing that because Weissman is a legend in documentary films. How was Sundance for you? Did you see movies that you know you're going to work with or think you're going to work with that are going to be picked up by some of the more nimble, smaller distributors?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, last year, as I was attending Sundance, again, my business is not buying films. My business is more working on films that get bought. And I ended up working on, I believe, 4 titles that were at Sundance last year, maybe 5, who come across, maybe not making a deal the day of Sundance, but, in the weeks to follow. And then as they're putting together a team, I'll come on. And I worked on films last year, including Connected, Shut Up Little Man, Another Happy Day with Ellen Barkin, and Crime After Crime as well.
Well, now, do you see more and more films going the small route? And I don't mean small in a negative way. What I mean is that Fox Searchlight can only pick up so many films. This year they picked up Beasts of the Southern Wild, which wound up winning the grand jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And I think they also picked up The Surrogate, which was the film about Mark O'Brien, the poet that was confined to an iron lung. And it's about his, he wants to lose his virginity and he hires a sex surrogate played by a very naked Helen Hunt. And those were two of the better reviewed films of the festival. But Fox Searchlight, let's face it, they can only buy so many films. And more, it's possible to actually release your films without going through a major distributor. Do you see more and more filmmakers going that route?
Definitely. And that's a big part of what I do. I mean, I can give you the exact example from last year of the movie Crime After Crime, which won a special jury prize at Sundance last year. And they got a deal from Oprah's network owned to release the film on television and video. And as part of that, they were given a window to do a small theatrical. So instead of, giving that away to someone else, they were able to hire someone like me to be able to help them get their film out to theaters. And it played in, I believe, over 50 theaters and really helped the value of the film as it got to other ancillary markets like video or even just community and non-theatrical bookings where libraries or organizations would bring in the film because of the awareness that was created on the theatrical level. So it really is a great way for people to expose their film to a larger audience without giving away all the rights and without giving away all the income as well.
Well, now this year at Sundance, what were the films that stood out for you?
A number of films really stood out to me, and a few of them, you know, already have secured distribution. I mean, the one that really blew me away, and I'm, now that it has distribution, I'm very happy to talk about it, so as not to drain my chances of getting it, was the film How to Survive a Plague. And I really thought, you know, I walked into it, I'd met with the producer last year, I really thought it was just going to be, you know, a very run-of-the-mill archival footage type movie. This was, if you didn't catch it, this is about, it chronicles the quest of ACT UP and the gay and lesbian community, mostly the gay community, to fight for the drug they needed to fight AIDS. And it starts from 1987 and goes through 1996, when the first of the, you know, cocktails became, made AIDS more of a livable disease. And it was year by year, everything they did to bring about this change and how many lives were lost during it. And I was really amazed by the emotion that came with it, because it really was just archival footage and a few interviews from today. But it was such a powerful struggle, chronicled over 8 years with numerous, with rising tolls each year of how many lives the disease had taken, and a victorious moment at the end. Really incredible. I've seen Sundance Select pick that up, and I think they can do a great job getting that out and really sharing the story of something I don't think a lot of us knew about.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a film that a lot of people were talking about up at Sundance, as was, of course, Beasts of the Southern Wild and The Surrogate.
Right.
And I guess, you know, the documentaries up at Sundance are pretty much world-renowned. It's probably one of the best festivals for documentaries, along with Rotterdam and a couple of others. Searching for Sugar Man, for instance, was a documentary that we talked about last week. It won the something up there this year. World Cinema Documentary Audience Award is what it won.
Right.
And I was surprised that How to Survive a Plague wasn't while picked up. It didn't win any awards.
I think it got one like special. I mean, there's so many special jury prizes that Sundance gives out. I think it got one for that, but I'm not. I can't recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, Sundance tends to, like, spread the awards around.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, I think, you know, it gets down to the jury being, oh, we really love this film. It's not the consensus choice, but I'd love to throw something its way. I mean, I've served on juries in the past where you give one grand jury a prize, and then there's one film that you really love. It's not, you know, by definition, the top film, whatever, you know, basis you use to judge that. But you want to give it a shout out and give it a special jury prize.
Well, the nice thing is that it's a much better environment in theatrical for documentaries. They are a lot more popular now. People will pay and go see a documentary, which 20, 30 years ago was very unusual for anything other than a nature film, perhaps. But I wonder, how soon did distributors, how soon did these people bring you into the conversation? Do they talk to you about your opinion on movies and say, what do you think about this, or the prospects of where we could place this film? Or is it only after they've finalized and picked up a movie that they start to turn to you and get your advice and your expert insight?
It's both. I wish it were more of the former. but yes, they're definitely coming to me and asking me, you know, what my opinions on theatrical, but keeping in mind that at the end of the day, theatrical is, you know, oftentimes the smallest avenue of revenue for these titles, especially with VOD now just becoming a huge part of how these films are getting out. You know, video was one thing. Now you can be in the homes of 50 million viewers nationwide at just the click of a button. So it's really, you know, brought on a whole new dimension to how films are released.
Well, now let's talk about that for a second, because last week, Michael Giltz, you had a question about, you know, why was Margin Call such a big deal? And it was because, well, it made $5 million theatrical, while at the same time making $5 million VOD. And had that ever been done before, where $10 million was made on two platforms simultaneously? And more, that's really the route that some of these films are taking. And, I mean, do you see the VOD route being almost usurping theatrical?
I hope not. That'd be bad for me. That might also be bad for, you know, viewers in general. But I do think that it, you know, I work on a lot of films that go VOD day and date or even beforehand. And let's face it, there's an audience out there for the cinema that doesn't necessarily have an art house or specialty movie theater in their area to be able to bring these films to. I mean, I think we've seen it again and again with VOD titles that as long as it's a strong title, In the larger markets where you have a committed movie-going audience, they want to see movies in movie theaters. And now, if you live, you know, a few hours away from, let's say, even 45 minutes away from a theater that you can't drive into, you can now see that without having to wait 4 months for it to be on video.
Do you have to actually, like, convince a theater owner, hey, listen, I know that this is going VOD, but please play this in your art house or in your theater because, you know...
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's a constant battle. Most commercial theater chains just will not play a film that's on VOD. And rightly so. I mean, they have a business to protect. A lot of the specialty screens, you know, have more discretion, and it'll come down to, yeah, if we think there's a theatrical audience for it, sure, we'll play it. If not, no, we're not going to play it. And I think it's kind of given independent theater owners a little more freedom to book their theaters instead of having to play everything that comes from a distributor. They can say, you know, it's already on VOD and we don't think the audience is strong enough theatrically. Or, yeah, we don't care that it's on VOD. We know that we can bring a theatrical audience in for it.
Yeah, there seemed to be that kind of whole buzz going on at Sundance this year about VOD and about video and theatrical being just another component to it. Do you think, that's from you know, a non-distribution or acquisitions executive standpoint. I don't know what it's like from someone such as, you know, a standpoint such as yourself.
Well, from a distributor standpoint, VOD is a point of sale right away. You don't have to wait. I mean, the thing with theatrical is you're spending money to advertise and promote. People buy tickets, and then, you know, 30, 60, 90 days later, you see your share of that income once the theater pays you. So it's a very protracted process of putting money out and getting money back in. With VOD, set up your deal, and you have a deal with the cable networks or the VOD providers, and they're paying you as stuff comes in.
Yeah, I imagine when you're booking theaters, obviously you look at big cities and strong theater-going towns like college towns. But I also imagine when they're doing video on demand at the same time that they want to make sure you go into a theater that's really good at generating press because you're raising the visibility of a movie so that the people in those towns that aren't near a movie theater will see stories about it online and then be more likely to find it on video on demand and go see that movie. So a town in Chicago, a theater in Chicago is great, but if you're choosing between two, I imagine the one that's really consistently good at getting local press and getting stuff written about their thing in Time Out Chicago and online in the newspaper, I imagine they'd be more valuable to you.
Sure, sure, definitely. Yeah.
Well, I mean, were there any pickups this year at Sundance where you just went, why did that get picked up? Like Red Lights, everybody, well, I'm not going to say what everybody was saying about it, but Red Lights was a film that, I guess, who did it star? Sigourney Weaver and Cillian Murphy, and it's this... It was described as an M. Night Shyamalan independent film, but it's not without M. Night. I was told, you know, maybe I shouldn't necessarily race to see it, but it was picked up.
I think I'd rather answer that the other way in terms of there were some films that I thought were very, very smart pickups that weren't necessarily, I mean, you've heard a lot of talk post-Sundance now about this wasn't the home run Sundance.
Well, what does that mean exactly? Because last year, 40 films were picked up, and I think I counted around 27 acquisitions this year. A little less, but there weren't any huge standouts.
Right. Like last year, there was a lot of money being poured out for this. And this year, the big ones seemed to have just been The Surrogate and Red Lights in terms of money being put out there. You know, $6 million for The Surrogate is a lot of money, but I think, you know, if anyone's going to pull it off, it's Fox Searchlight. If they do this properly, that's not only an awards film, but also one that's just has to be seen for its, you know, there is a prurient nature to it, but it's also a true story. It's an amazing story. I think it's in great hands with them and could really more than pay for itself based on that. I think Magnolia Pictures was very smart in picking up Queen of Versailles. That's the kind of doc that is just something that puts reality TV to shame. They couldn't capture something like that on these programs, and seeing just this off-the-wall family that really can be quite a talking point as they get that out there.
Now, this is about the family that is the billionaire family that's building, you know, living in a 26,000 square foot house and building a 90,000 square foot house, and they run into a little financial problem or two.
Yeah, exactly. And I love the, you know, I love the risk that Sony Classics took on Searching for Sugar Man. I mean, people really came out of that film not knowing much about Rodriguez and saying, wow, how do we miss this guy? You know, and it could be the thing where that is just a newfound fame for that musician and for his story across the world.
Oh, granted, he's in his 70s now. This was the artist that released two albums in the 70s, two folk albums in the 70s. Sure. They didn't go anywhere. They sold about 6 copies in the U.S. However, unbeknownst to him, he was a huge hit in South Africa.
Right.
And I guess, you know, nobody knew what had happened to him. And two folks, a DJ and a record store owner down in South Africa, went on a quest to find him. And it's a very moving film. Now, were there any other films that you would say, certainly we talked about How to Survive a Plague, but any other films that you would suggest people try and catch when they hit theaters and or VOD near them?
So let me see here. I mean, I myself at not seeing Beasts of the Southern Wild, I just heard it's amazing. One documentary that we haven't talked about yet that really blew a lot of people away was The Ambassador. I don't know if you caught that.
I did see that, and I thought, okay, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a film about a man who goes to Central Africa and buys his diplomatic credentials solely so that he can sneak blood diamonds out of the country. And he's doing it only to show how easy it is to do.
Right.
And how corrupt the system is. Well, those are all the things that I assumed. So I didn't really find it as.
Right. Yeah, no, I think what I think audiences were similarly divided in that. Yes. The point that he's making is pretty well known already, but some of the audiences that I saw reacting to it were just more taken about his style of filmmaking, of putting himself right in the middle of that madness, kind of taking the Michael Moore approach a step much further, and assuming not only an identity, but great risk involved. You know, a number of the people that he interviewed during the course of the film are no longer with us today, of how dangerous a position he put himself in there. And that's something that, you know, I think that you could be seeing on various VOD platforms as something that wouldn't have made its way to a lot of audiences had it not been for the availability of VOD to deliver that.
Well, certainly you were right in the middle of Sundance and Michael Tuckman from M. Tuckman Media. Now, I guess, should we send people to your website?
Sure. It's www.mtuckmanmedia.com.
And of course, we'll place a link to that in the show notes. Are you on Twitter?
I should be. I'm not. here's my vocal Twitter right now. I'm going to tweet for folks in Los Angeles to show up to the New Art this weekend and catch a screening of Crazy Horse that's really going to blow them away.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us about this year's Sundance Film Festival. I look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys. Good talking to you as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, that sounds like, I'm sorry I missed Sundance. Sounds like there were some good movies, even if they're not necessarily scoring big dollars from distributors. But the top documentary at the festival was The House I Live In, which I don't think we talked about yet.
No, and I don't think we have. And of course, now I'm forgetting who, I know who directed it, but it's one of the Jarecki brothers. And I can't remember which one it was. I want to say it was Eugene Jarecki who directed Why We Fight, which was a documentary about the war machine. And this is a documentary about the drug war and how it's failing and how it predominantly focuses on African-Americans and minorities. And for me, I thought it was an interesting film, but it was also, you know, about 40 minutes too long. Where when you're seeing the same footage for the fifth time, your documentary is probably a little too long.
So why did it win the top prize?
Because it tells a very important story, and it does so in a very interesting way. He basically starts with his own story and about his, not nanny, but a family friend who was African-American and how one of her sons died due to drugs and was involved in the drug trade. And he kind of started to walk down this path of what is the drug war and why is it failing? And it does go very, very deep into the subject. I don't necessarily think it wasn't as well done as I thought it could have been.
Mm-hmm. So you don't expect it to win awards come after it gets put out in theaters, maybe down the road. You don't think it's going to score a lot of attention or prizes?
No, I think it probably will because it does tell an important story. I just hope that he cuts it so that it's a little bit more succinct and to the point.
Well, there were a lot of other films that won awards this week. Some of the big prizes that were given out were the Directors Guild. They honored, of course, the artist Michel Hazanavicius, if I'm saying that properly.
Yes.
He won Best Director. That's obviously a big harbinger for the Oscars. And then the Producers Guild also named the artist the best film of the year, ipso facto. That's their top award, basically. So that shows a lot of momentum for that film, even though, again, we're talking about essentially a silent movie and a foreign film.
And a black and white movie. Let's not forget.
And a black and white movie. Though that's sort of popular among Oscar voters. So, yeah, all those strikes against it, I would still not say it is the unquestionable front runner. I'd say it's always going to be an underdog until it actually wins, but it's very exciting. And of course, the one little blip on the road is SAG. Not only did it give Best Ensemble to The Help, it put a little roadblock in Meryl Streep's path to the Oscar by giving Viola Davis, a very good actress, Best Actress for her starring role in The Help. So all that will shake out once we get to the Oscars, but it certainly is looking good for the artist right now.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think that, I don't know, I looked at all of these, and granted, I was coming back from Sundance and trying to get reacquainted with life in general, but still, the DGA, the PGA, SAG, all in the same, like, one day after another. Like, it's, you get, like, awards shock.
But these are the ones that matter, though, because these are people who, a big chunk of their voters will be voting at the Oscars. So these are far more important than all the critics' lists and Golden Globes and all that stuff. These are awards voted on, in part, by people who will vote for the Oscar. So these are the ones you really should pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, awards fatigue was the word I was looking for. And, you know, I was flipping through the little throwaway rag that, you know, they put at the end of your driveway in some of the suburban towns, like the weekly shopper, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and quite honestly, if you live in a suburban town and, you know, some of the issues are quite important, that's where you'll find them, because you're not going to find them in, you know, the Los Angeles Times, which isn't going to cover them. But I'm flipping through this this rag, if you will, and past all of the, you know, advertisements for local futon dealers and, you know, horseback riding lessons. And lo and behold, in the middle of the newspaper, there's this ad for Hugo, this 4-year consideration ad for Hugo.
Well, it's L.A.
And I'm just thinking, are you kidding me?
It's L.A. No stone unturned.
It's literally no stone. I must live around a whole bunch of, you know, Academy voters.
Absolutely. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm traveling around the country, and I stopped at a gas station in Florida, and they had a weekly, a rag, if you will. It was not a newspaper. It was at the front counter where you're paying for your soda. It costs $1, and it's called Mugshots. And for $1, you get this little color newspaper filled with like 100 or 200 mugshots of people who are on the lam, wanted by the police. And I think the idea is that you spot them and then you get to get the reward if you turn them in. I've never seen anything like it, but the front page photo was a double stabber. So that was very exciting.
So wait, I'm confused. Were you saying that you picked up all of the copies because you didn't want people to notice that you were?
Yeah, I had to buy every copy. That's right. But another thing I've noticed on the road is that a lot of my friends are listening to Spotify. Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, every place I stayed at, people listen to Spotify. They pay the monthly fee. They either avoid or don't avoid some of the ads, and they don't all go to the ultimate premium level, but they all love the ability to just play any music that they want. And you're seeing subscription services and digital music become the dominant part of the music business. They're really coming of age, as we can see by digital music sales around the world.
Yes, and that is our music news this week, is that global digital music sales are up 8% in 2011 to $5.2 billion. And that's really according to the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, or IFPI, as it's known.
So do they give you a total sales, or why do they break out? Do they say, and total sales are $6 billion, or how much was physical music?
There were so many figures in this report. I mean, this report went on.
But shouldn't the top figure be the total sales?
It should be, but I think this was specific to digital music sales.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, they're saying that, you know, up 8% globally, and that compares to growth of about 5% in 2010. And
so it's accelerating.
Yeah. And they've only really started measuring digital revenues since 2004.
Well, that's only when they should have, really, probably.
Yeah. 3.6 billion downloads were purchased globally in 2011, which is an increase of 17%. And that combines both singles and album downloads.
Right. No matter whether you're digitally downloading a single track or an entire album at once. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time where, at least, you know, in the mid 2000s, where you had to say, oh, this is a 35 millimeter film and this is a digital film. So you'd have, like, in all of these computer systems that were for movie theaters, you'd have like two different entries for a film title. You'd have, you know, Mission Impossible and then Mission Impossible Digital. And that way you could separate, like, okay, what did the digital theater make as opposed to what did the traditional 35 millimeter film make. And now,
nobody cares.
Now nobody cares. And I'm seeing now that, you know, in some markets, you know, more than half the revenues are derived from digital channels. And specifically in the US, where it's 52%, and in South Korea is 53%. So at some point, it's going to be what are music sales, not what are digital music sales.
Well, that's what it should be anyway. I don't know why. I mean, it's nice to break it down, but you should have a total figure here. But that's their fault. But yeah, I mean, in the US, it's 52% of digital sales. But then there's also subscription services, and there's also satellite radio. So if you look at the total pie, as far as physical media, buying a CD or LP compared to digital, whether it's accessing a subscription or accessing satellite radio or buying digital music, that's probably got to be 65% of the total pie by now, at least.
Yeah, probably. And, you know, the record companies have got to be really happy because album sales, digital albums, where instead of people buying just the 99-cent song, they're buying the, you know, $7 to $12, well, I guess it's not 12, but $7 to $10 digital album. That's up 24% across the world. And in the U.S., it's up 19%. In the U.K., it's up 27%. In France, it's up 71%. So the big problem with iTunes was that, gee, Steve Jobs made it so that the single alive again. He you know, gave a new life to the single. And now people are only buying 99-cent products instead of buying our $12, $14 albums. Well, I guess people are going back to buying albums again.
Well, I don't think so. As far as the whole pie, it's still dominated by singles. We are in an era more like the 50s and early 60s where people buy songs much more than they buy albums. They weren't buying any albums digitally. Now they're doing that a little bit more, and that's great. But as if you look at the whole pie, it's still dominated by single sales. It's not dominated by album sales. It's not nearly what it was in the 80s. So it's a good a good correction to what was a complete lack of digital album sales. Now we're seeing people who buy entire albums, but still, this is an era where people buy singles, they buy EPs, they go see them in concert. It's just not a world where you're seeing 3, 4, 5 million copies of albums being sold. Yeah, that's only the top album of the year selling a couple million copies, as opposed to the 80s, where you'd see 20 albums sell 3 or 4 million copies or more, and the top album would have 8 or 10 million. We're not seeing album sales rebounding overall, but it's good to see people are buying albums digitally in increasing numbers, because there's no reason not to. It's still a great format. But like I mentioned, Spotify is becoming really popular. That was my impression traveling around the country, and we see it's backed up by the numbers.
That's right. I mean, Spotify now has 3 million paid subscribers, which is and it has a 20% conversion rate, meaning...
What does that mean?
So that means, like, you know, if five people sign up for the free version, so like the trial version, or, you know, they just want to get the 10 hours of music for free, which frankly is what I should be doing because I don't think I listen to Spotify more than 10 hours a month. But anyway, at least one of those five, one out of every five people is actually then paying either $5 or $9.99 or whatever it is for the upgraded services.
Well, that's a really good conversion rate, obviously, if they can get people to sample it and 20% of them end up paying for the fuller subscription price, then they're doing great.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, Paul McGinnis, who is the manager of U2, was saying, look, you know, part of the issue here with Spotify, and we don't hate them, we don't dislike them, we just think that right now Spotify cuts deals with the album label, you know, with the record labels, and it's not transparent. We have no idea what they're being paid, these record labels, and therefore we don't know how much money we're supposed to be making, and so we're just trusting...
And we do know that...
We're trusting the fox to tell the farmer, don't worry, we're guarding the hen house. They're all there.
Well, and we do know that the royalty rate is way too low. People can have millions of plays on Spotify and Pandora and get very little money. It's not remotely equivalent, of course, to what it would be in the old days, but a better royalty rate is probably in the cards. And the more transparent it is, the more likely that is to happen. Of course, the big thing is that with Spotify and especially Pandora, there are ads, and the radio ad market in the country is still a massive market. And now Pandora is saying, we're the biggest radio network in the country. We got so many people listening to us. Online radio grossed $800 million in ad revenue in 2011. And that does not include Pandora and Spotify. So that is a big growing market. And if you look at traditional radio, that's like a $15 billion market last year. So there are a lot of people on Pandora and Spotify. And traditional radio is looking over its shoulder because those guys are really starting to focus on getting the ad dollars that are being spent locally to go to their national platforms.
Yeah, and that's really what it amounts to. It's kind of like, you know, it used to be like, oh, you know, Michael Giltz is calling long distance from New York. You know, well, now, I mean, there is no such thing as long distance within the United States and within most countries. You know, and I think the same thing is true of radio. Radio, you know, there's K-Rock in Los Angeles and there's Kiss FM in New York. I don't even know what radio stations are around in New York. And frankly, I barely know the ones that are here in Los Angeles. But the reality is Pandora, which allows you, you know, a user to come on and select an artist or a song and then build a radio station around that with similar artists and or songs. That's Pandora. Spotify is, you know, basically all you can eat. You know, you can pick the artists you want and make your own playlists. It's a lot of fun, actually.
And when you have a national audience, it's easier to sell national ads, so they can cherry pick a lot of ad campaigns.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I was headed, is that now, instead of advertising just in the New York market or just in the Dallas market, now you can say, I'm going to advertise on Pandora, and I'm going to get people all over the country, if not world.
Well, it's a shame to lose that local flavor for DJs, because a local DJ who can reflect the community and local musical tastes and support local bands and get regional hits and, you know, be a part of the community, you lose a lot of that when you only have national radio, which is what we're moving towards. But I will say that it's probably like cable TV versus your local TV. In the old days, local TV and the networks dominated the ad dollars, and then cable showed up and they started to take more and more of the pie. And now probably half of the pie of TV ads goes to cable, and another half goes to local and major networks. So I think Pandora and Spotify are saying, hey, we're going to get a lot bigger piece of the pie than we are right now.
Yes, I would agree with you on that. And I think they're absolutely right. I mean, plus there's RDO, there's MOG. These are all these, you know, streaming music services that are in competition with one another. And, you know, I haven't really played around with RDO and MOG. I've played around with Spotify. I listened to it quite a bit. In fact, you know, with Coachella coming up, there's no way I can go and buy all of the albums that for all of the artists that are there. I think there's, what, 200 artists that are playing Coachella. No way I can buy all of them. But then you go onto the Coachella website, and there's all these people creating playlists for each day of the festival, all 3 days. And I'm listening to some of these playlists and thinking, wow, I've never heard this particular musician or artist, and they're really good. So I'm actually discovering artists, which is exactly what's supposed to happen through something like Spotify.
That's right. And that's hopefully what will continue to grow. And certainly a lot of people are discovering artists on Broadway, because Broadway is a happening place this season. It's the spring season. Broadway shows used to get played on radio all the time. Broadway shows were a source for big hits on the radio. South Pacific and the Sound of Music in Oklahoma.
Well,
they
what
were
about
the big
plays?
Popular
were,
hits
were,
of the day.
Were plays also big? I mean, were plays kind of a big thing on the radio? I guess they were, like radio dramas were big.
Well, they did radio dramas adapting movies and plays, and they put them on the radio with all-star casts, absolutely. But today we have one of the biggest hits in years, The Book of Mormon, with great songs created by the guys from South Park. You're not going to hear them on the, you're not going to hear Turn It Off or some of the other big hit songs in the show played on anything but a really minor specialty channel on Sirius satellite radio, which is a shame because there are some great catchy songs that aren't too filthy and could be popular hits.
But do you think the Book of Mormon is really kind of shining a spotlight on Broadway these days? I mean, here are some hip guys who create South Park. They've moved to Broadway, and now people who would normally never pay attention to Broadway are not only paying attention to it, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Book of Mormon, the national tour in Denver, sold out in like half an hour or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, it's a monster hit. It's in not one of the biggest houses, so there's a massive demand for the tickets that are available at that theater. And every week or so, we hear that it set a new box office record. And they just made an announcement over the past week, which is kind of unusual. The entire cast, essentially, has signed on for a second year in the show.
So the whole every cast member has signed on for the second year then?
Not every, but essentially all the big names who are in this, the people who became sort of Broadway stars thanks to the show, like Josh Gad and Andrew Rannells and Rory O'Malley, are young people. They've probably had a lot of opportunities, but for various reasons, they've all decided to stay with the show for a second year. Being in a big hit is exhausting, and you've got a lot of opportunities. I imagine Josh Gad in particular has possibilities in movie and television. And they're having a great time, and they're making money, Broadway money, but still good money. And they've all signed on for a second year. I can't remember that happening in ages, especially since you're talking about people who've gotten heat and attention and celebrity for this, and therefore this is their chance to strike while they aren't as hot. I think there's a lot of reasons why they decided to do that. I think the big one is that it's a great show and they're having a great time.
Well, you know, that's precisely why we stay with Showbiz Sandbox, and certainly we've, you know, we know what it's like to take a lot of heat and have all those opportunities flow in our general.
That's right. Right. Anyway. So they released a press release, and it was amusing. Andrew Rannells, who is my favorite in the show, he plays the lead young Mormon who's going out on a mission. And he said, quote, "The producers said they would release the location of where they are holding my family if I re-signed. I love my family and want to see them return safely. So here I am." And they had typical cheeky little comments from these people, obviously in the spirit of this South Park-like show. But it's part of the season. It was the biggest hit from last year. It won the best musical. And this year, I can't remember the year when I've seen so much change in the schedule on Broadway. There are a lot of plays and musicals that see it's a wide open race, and people are angling to get on their show on Broadway. We've had Newsies coming from New Jersey. We have Once coming from off-Broadway. We have Leap of Faith, which is a new musical based on the Steve Martin film. That's opening in the spring. The Clybourne Park, which is a terrific drama that is sort of a sequel in a way to A Raisin in the Sun, featuring a white family living in the home where the black family lived in the original play. It's a very clever play that opened in London to great reviews. They're coming to Broadway. It's a lot of things happening at the last minute. I can't remember seeing the season this up in the air. It's kind of like movies where we know what's coming out next summer and what movies are coming out in July and August and June. It's sort of mapped out already.
Well,
it's
especially when half your films are based on movies, you kind of know.
And I'm saying in the movies, just like where we know what movies are coming out, you typically know what Broadway shows are popping in. This year, there's been a lot more activity than I've seen. So it makes Broadway a really fun and exciting place to be.
Well, you also have, you know, Matthew Broderick returning. So that helps in a new musical. If you, what is it? Nice Work If You Can Get It, I believe is what he's going to star in. Speaking
That's
of
great.
Which. Did you see the little car commercial he's doing where he reprises the Ferris? Yeah, it's kind of interesting. He takes on Ferris Bueller again, and instead of calling in sick to school, he calls in sick to work as a, you know, big
in
time
a movie.
Yeah, big time movie actor.
And it's all an ode to the movie. It's like 2.5 minutes long, including a kicker at the end. I wonder how much they paid the John Hughes estate and the studio that owns Ferris Bueller, because it's not an homage. It is literally, you know, recycled stuff, including the music.
That's right. And, you know, down to different plot points of singing in the parade. And Paramount owns the rights to Ferris Bueller. And I was wondering the same thing myself.
It must have cost them a pretty penny, but it is a fun ad.
Yes. And it's going to air during the Super Bowl. So.
Oh, yeah. I already saw it online.
Yes, I know. I think that once half of it leaked, they said, screw it. We're going to release all of it. But yeah,
I don't think that's a big deal. I think the fact that you get to see it on the Super Bowl, even if people have peeked at it online, there's going to be a couple hundred million people watching the Super Bowl. So I don't think that will spoil the big deal of debuting that song during the Super Bowl and that ad, I should say. And you know what? It'll probably be the best darn ad in the Super Bowl because it's been a weak few years, and that's a really good creative one.
Yes, and I know you. I kind of saw a small hint there that you were trying to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, but I agree with you. I was thinking the same thing myself, and I was like, you know what? When you debut during the Super Bowl, you're compared to all of the other commercials that premiere, all of those, you know, expensive commercials that premiere during the Super Bowl. In this case, you're, you know, you have basically the world to yourself. And everybody's talking about your commercial. And then those that didn't see it will probably be with those that have when the commercial airs. And therefore, people will say, hey, pay attention to this. I've seen this commercial. It's pretty funny. But now it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment headlines and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Once again, Bruce Springsteen has a much-anticipated new album, this one titled Wrecking Ball. Once again, Bruce Springsteen is hitting the road for a world tour to promote a new album. And once again, Ticketmaster will bungle sales for the boss in his home state of New Jersey, letting most of the tickets fall into the hands of scalpers.
Will or has?
Has. I should say has.
Okay.
As Digital Music News put it, this couldn't have happened to a more high-profile artist at a worse time or in a worse place. It's caused New Jersey Congressman Bill, is it Pascrell?
I don't know.
Bill Pascrell to ponder reintroducing the BOSS Act. And in case you're wondering, the BOSS Act stands for, now stay with me here, Better Oversight of Secondary Sales and Accountability in Concert Ticketing.
All right.
So I think PIPA is a little bit more of a, anyway. And, you know, basically it would require companies like Ticketmaster to disclose how many tickets are being held back for special use or artist allocations, or fan clubs, or the like, while prohibiting primary sellers from reselling tickets in the secondary market at more than face value. And I think when I first read that, I thought, well, why wouldn't secondary market be allowed to sell for more than face value? But that's not what it's saying. It's saying it's prohibiting primary sellers, i.e. Ticketmaster, from reselling their tickets to the secondary market for a markup.
So if Ticketmaster wants to put a face value of $1,000 on a ticket, they can, or $5,000, any price they want. What they can't do is say, oh, our top ticket is $250, and before they put them on sale, offer them to a secondary market for $500 so that, you know, they get to take the bigger cut but pretend they're selling tickets for a lower price.
Correct.
Big interesting.
Deal, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. Springsteen has always been plagued with these problems. In defense of him, I'll say it's because the demand for him is so great, especially in New Jersey. He's one of the best live acts of all time. But, you know, we've talked to the guys who wrote the book Ticketmasters about the industry and things that can be done. There are smart, reasonable steps that can be done to stop a lot of this. They shouldn't need legislation to do it. And the fault lies with Ticketmaster and Springsteen. There are steps they can take, and they know them, to avoid this. So, you know, shame on them.
We did talk to the authors of Ticketmasters and Josh Baron and Dean Budnick. That is on episode 129. If you go back in time, you can find that. It was a very interesting conversation. And I agree with you, Michael. I think that, you know, Springsteen could actually start a fan club, and for $10 a year, you get to purchase tickets early. U2 does it. Pearl Jam does it. And they're...
Well, that doesn't solve stuff, because I know people who joined the Police fan club for their big final tour, and they got to pay an extra $100 to get early access, and they still ended up not getting anything. You know, they still ended up being the upper deck. So none of these particular steps, you got to do a big approach. Fan club is not the solution. It's one key or possibility, but there's a lot of things you need to do, and they need to do all of them, and they're not even trying.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a couple of people complaining in forums that, hey, you know what, I was trying to buy tickets, and I realized, you know, 5 minutes before tickets went on sale on StubHub, there were tickets for the show that hadn't even gone on sale yet.
Yeah.
And so, right. You know, I think that I agree with this. If we knew how many tickets were actually for sale, I think it would keep artists a little bit, I'm not talking about Bruce Springsteen, but I'm talking about artists in general, would keep them a little more honest, and they wouldn't hold back 50% of the tickets for, you know, either the artist's take or promotional.
But is there any reason legally why they should have to disclose that? I mean, if they want to, they can. What's, you know, why should they have to reveal their inner business workings? We don't force, you know, grocery stores and restaurants and other people to show, well, how many reservations do you have set aside for bigwigs? I went to your restaurant and couldn't get a reservation. Why am I being forced to wait in line and someone else can walk in and get a seat?
Yeah, but is a restaurant affecting millions of people? Is that, I mean, in this case,
I'm just asking. It's a concert ticket. It's not healthcare.
Well, then moving on, I guess we can talk about Rio. And I'm not talking about the city, Michael, although I guess I am talking about the city, but I'm talking about the animated film Rio, which was a big hit last year. It's nominated for a Best Animated Film Oscar this year. Now Sergio Mendes, who actually scored the film and is, of course, nominated for the song Real in Rio, he says that maybe himself and Carlos Saldana, both of whom are from Brazil, might do a sequel and tie it into the 2014 World Cup. Of course, there's no script and no deals are in place. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because the movie made $500 million and it only cost $90 million to make. So, of course, there's going to be a sequel. I don't think there's time to tie it into the 2014 World Cup because they would have to have started filming a year ago. Animated films take a long time to make. I don't think Sergio Mendes realizes that. So that particular plot line may not work out. But it's a big hit. It deserves to have a sequel. And of course there will be one.
Well, you know, he's the composer. So, oh yeah, I don't know. All I get is the idea. It took me half an hour. I don't know what accent that was. That was my like Italian.
I'm not
Brazilian.
Sure either.
Yeah.
Move on. Let's see if we can offend the Sikh community. So let's
the
move
Sikh
on.
Community? This, yeah. Well, yeah. If we can't offend the Sikh community, then I do know somebody who can. And, you know, that's probably because he's done offending all of the other late night talk show hosts. And that is Jay Leno, who was doing this bit about the GOP presidential candidates and all of their homes. And he showed up a picture of the real life homes of Ron Paul and then Newt Gingrich. But then when he showed Mitt Romney's home as a way of saying, oh, look, this guy's so rich that he lives in this huge mansion. He showed this, I guess it was like a temple, the Golden Temple in Amritsar, India. And it's a Sikh holy site. And well, the Sikh community was none too happy about that. And they let NBC know it and started a petition. But then you had the State Department, Victoria Nuland, who's a spokeswoman for the State Department. She told the BBC that, look, you know, free speech and frankly, you know, I'm sure Mr. Leno would, quote, be appreciative if we make the point that his comments are constitutionally protected in the United States under free speech. And frankly, they appear to be satirical in nature. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I don't know why she felt the need to say what he said was fine. I mean, if they're offended, they're offended. Why tell them they shouldn't be offended? He could have shown Buckingham Palace. He could have shown the Taj Mahal. He could have shown a lot of things. He happened to show a holy site. So it was perhaps not in the best taste for people in the Sikh community. And hopefully in the future, he'll realize that and be a little more sensitive. It's one thing to show, you know, a lavish home. Another thing to show Mecca.
Right, so, exactly. Know,
but if Jay Leno is not in the business of offending people or pushing buttons, I'm sure he regrets it and will be more cautious in the future.
In fact, he does quite the opposite, in my opinion. But well, we were just talking about Spotify, but it turns out that they are looking for more financing. According to, I guess it was Michael Robertson, who is the MP3.com founder, he says that his sources tell him that they need more capital. They've already raised like close to $200 million, and they're looking to raise several hundred million dollars more. Big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I'm not quite sure why Spotify needs more cash. It's not transparent to me whether they are having cash flow problems or whether they want to expand or innovate and they need the cash to do it. So, you know, it's always interesting when someone who's just raised a couple hundred million dollars says we need a lot more. Well, that raises my eyebrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this case, Spotify, you know, they haven't gone public, so they're doing all of this on private equity and the money that they're making and their revenue. But yeah, to expand at the rate and that they have, you need money. And a lot of people will, like a Facebook or Google, they'll become public and they'll raise, you know, $20, $30 billion and then use that money to expand and then eventually pay back their shareholders by increasing the value of their stock. In this case, Spotify does not have that option because they're private. So,
and the big issue here is that while we talk about the royalty rate not being high enough to satisfy artists, their big expense is forking bucketfuls of cash over to the record labels because so many people are listening to their songs.
That's absolutely correct. They're probably their biggest expense is not technology or paying, you know, exorbitant salaries to executives. It's paying exorbitant fees to record companies. But anyway, that's Spotify. We can move over to another subscription service, Netflix, which apparently is growing again, although barely, and they beat some fourth quarter expectations. The stock was up 13% after Netflix announced that they, instead of losing 800,000 subscribers as they did in the third quarter, they actually gained 610,000 U.S. subscribers, bringing their total to $24.4 million domestic customers, 21.67 million.
Why? Don't say the 0.67.
So, okay.
It's too confusing. It's too many numbers. So they got 24 million customers and 21 million of them pay $8 a month for internet streaming. And another 11 million pay $8 a month for DVDs by mail.
Right. But they're not saying how many are hybrid customers. But, you know.
Well, we can do the math.
Well, yes and no, because technically together that would be, you know, 30-something million, 35 million customers.
Well, we know probably a maximum of 3 million do just one, because there has to be at least 8 million overlap, because they have 21 million people paying $8 a month for internet. There's only 24 million people, and 21 million of them. So that means 3 million of them at most do only DVDs.
Yes. Well,
so 8 million of them are overlap. 8 million of them probably do both.
Reed Hastings, the CEO, says, hey, you know, quarter after quarter after quarter, you're going to see DVD subscriptions decline and streaming subscriptions increase. Right now, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Streaming beats out DVDs 2-to-1. They're not going to be doing the rental of video games as they had announced when they were going to bifurcate the company into two different companies. They may do 3D streaming, however. The big news, in my opinion, is that this Warner Brothers deal that they're signing, they not only have to delay the release of DVDs and or streaming to their customers by 56 days from the launch of the DVD or Blu-ray, but their customers can't even put those titles in their queue until 28 days after the film is released on DVD or Blu-ray.
So people see the movie comes out on DVD, they go to Netflix to try and add it to their queue just to remind themselves that in a month they want to watch it, and they can't even do that.
Correct.
Well, that's very, very stupid for Warner Brothers.
Big deal or big whoop on all of this news, Michael?
It's all a big whoop in a way. Warner Brothers is stupid to punish customers and not let them at least put it on a to-do list that in a month from now, I want to watch a Warner Brothers movie. Why would you want to stop people from doing that? Even if you're going to make them wait, What possible advantage is there for that? Two, it's stupid that people overreacted with Netflix's troubles. They're at $95 per share. That's way down. That's a third of what they had in July, their peak of $295. But still, I imagine they'll continue to go up and up again because there was too much of a correction. And finally, I'm not quite sure if anybody cares that they're streaming 3D movies.
Yeah, I don't really care. I mean, to me, the big news is this. You have to wait 28 days to add something to your
queue. It serves no purpose that I can think of.
Well, they're trying to increase their DVD sales, and I don't think that's going to do it.
But it doesn't do it.
I mean, especially when, look at our next story, YouTube. It's hitting 4 billion daily video views. Every day, 4 billion streams leave the YouTube servers. That's remarkable to me. 60 hours of video is now uploaded to YouTube every single minute. So that 4 billion video views, 25% increase in the past 8 months alone.
That's a lot of crazy cats.
Keyboard cats. That's true. Yeah. And guess what? They're generating $5 billion in revenue, YouTube is, on an annualized basis. Although what they're saying is most of the 4 billion videos that get viewed, about 3 billion of them every day are not monetized. So there's still a lot of room for growth there. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It continues to grow. You know, YouTube has to keep innovating because there are a lot of other sites with valuable content that people are seeking out. YouTube is in a weird place where people sort of stumble on stuff or get sent it by friends. And so it's a constant need to feed the beast and get people to come back to there. It's not natural. Like you go back next week to see Friends or Seinfeld or, you know, a show that you like. This is a constant need to bring people back. It's not easy. For the moment, they're doing a good job.
Well, now then, let's move on to the X Factor, because Simon Cowell, you know, the guy behind American Idol and the X Factor, both in the U.S. and the U.K.
It seems more like The Apprentice. It's turned into The Apprentice and everybody's getting fired.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a moment. But first, we're going to talk about Simon Cowell's new global TV show that he wants to make, which is basically X Factor to find the world's greatest DJs. He's going to, you know, the show is still unnamed, but he's going to basically pit all of these DJs against one another and come up with the world's greatest DJ. Big deal or big whoop?
Is it an ongoing series or is it meant to discover new talent? I'm not sure if you mean it's DJs as in world-class talent who comes together in a competition to find the best one or whether it's let's find the next top DJ.
I think it's to find the best DJ. The former.
Well, then you would only do it once. DJs are a big worldwide phenomenon. I don't know if their skills translate to television. You know, they do sets that last several hours. Not sure how it would work. I can understand why he wants to try to do it and find the right format. It seems pretty difficult to do on a weekly show, but more power to him. I wouldn't rule him out.
Well, speaking of ruling people out, turns out Simon Cowell not only is starting new shows, but he's also tweaking the ones that he's already on, which is, of course, The X Factor. Steve Jones, the host. Nicole Scherzinger, who was kind of the host, but then moved into a judging role. And Paula Abdul, who Cowell worked with on American Idol before she was kind of fired. And then now he brought over to X Factor. Well, he now fired all three of those people in retooling the X Factor. I guess he wasn't happy that only 12 million people were watching the X Factor instead of the 20 million people he had hoped for. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. The show had a strong first season. They did a great job of getting really good talent. I really still was wildly impressed by the talent. But Steve Jones had terrible chemistry with the judges. It was inevitable that he would be gone. Nobody liked each other on the show. Steve Jones really did not get along with the judges. Nicole Scherzinger was terrible, offered literally nothing the entire time that she was on the show. She was a bad judge. I'm surprised by Paula Abdul. I don't think I would have eliminated her as well, but L.A. Reid did a good job. He and Simon had good chemistry. The host was going to go. I recommended he get rid of the host and Nicole, so I'm not surprised by that at all. Paula is a bit of a surprise, but the format is strong. They got great talent, and they knew they needed to do a lot of tweaks and changes to keep it going and keep it fresh, and they need to find that right balance, and that was the amazing thing about Idol. They had three judges who worked really well together. It's not easy to come up with that chemistry, and the X Factor is going to keep working at it till they do.
Now, I know that, you know, right before we started recording today, I mentioned that we got a couple of emails taking you to task for saying that American Idol was doing really, really well, when in fact it had declined in viewership and the ratings went down.
Well, hopefully that's why people turn into our podcast. If you watch Entertainment Tonight or you read the newspapers, they give you this dumb short-term perspective that American Idol is down 18% from last year. It's in trouble. It's lost 4 million viewers. It's nowhere near the force it once was. Well, of course not. It's 11 years into the show. But we tell you, look, take a step back. this is still the number one show in the country. And to say a show that is the number one show in the country is doing terrible is really not a very smart perspective. Is it down from last year? Yes, it is. It's 11 seasons in. It'd be remarkable if it wasn't off the air. Instead, it is still the number one show in the country. It looks like it's going to be number one for an unbelievable 8 years in a row. At some point, that will slide off and it won't be the number one show in the country. And it'll still be top 10 for a few more years. And that won't be the end of the world. American Idol is the biggest show in America. It's one of the biggest hits of all time. It is still doing tremendously well. Yes, it's down from last year, but if you put it in perspective and look at the long term and where it ranks compared to other shows on television, it's the bomb. It's the top hit. How much better can you do than number one?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just goes to show you much, you know, we often talk about album sales and how, gee, you know, number five only sold 50,000 albums, you know, this week. Well, you know, if it's
better than selling 5,000 copies.
Right. But I guess if you look at it, it's like, well, it's still number one and it's got less viewers. That means that either A, fewer people are watching television, which I don't believe, or two, those people who are watching television are spread out much thinner. They're watching all, yeah. Instead of watching three shows, they're watching 50.
Right. The number one show in the 80s was much bigger hit than the number one show today. I mean, you're talking about 30, 35 million viewers, you know.
Right. So, exactly.
Yeah. But again, it's number one. You know, yes, it's down, but it can't be much better than that.
Well, now, speaking of number one, Bruno Mars, who is also, you know, gunning for some big Grammys. He may be steamrolled by Adele, but there's one area where he can't be beat. Best-selling singles worldwide. Mars holds the number one and number two slots for the top-selling singles of 2011. He also has a third single in the top 10, Just the Way You Are, which is...
No. That's Just the Way You Are is the number one song, I believe.
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's the biggest hit, yeah.
Well, he sold 12.5 million copies worldwide, and Grenade has sold 10.2 million copies. The Lazy Song sold 6.5 million copies worldwide, which must be the third song.
Yeah.
Adele's not doing so bad either. She's the first artist in history to have three singles hit number one at the same time as the album they came from was also at number one. So, is the success of Mars a big deal or a big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think this came from the same press release that we discussed earlier in the music section about digital sales worldwide. He has sold 38 million, 39 million singles last year. That's a lot of singles. That's the equivalent of selling, of course, almost 4 million copies of an album, roughly speaking. That's amazing. They were clearly in an era where singles dominate, and Bruno Mars is a terrific artist. Doo-Wop and Hooligans, a terrific album. And that's really a fascinating thing, how you can sell so many copies of your singles because it's so easy now. You hear a song on the radio, click, you got it.
Yeah, that's true. Or you go to Spotify.
Yep.
Bookstores have been very reluctant to do business with Amazon's new publishing arm. Barnes & Noble, for one, refuses to carry any hardcover unless they can also sell the ebook version to their Nook customers. Many indie stores are similarly wary, but reality often takes over. Many indie stores carry the books published by Barnes & Noble, often public domain titles, and major publisher Houghton Mifflin began by carrying trade paperbacks of Amazon titles. So that's kind of weird. It's like a publishing company carrying a title from a retailer. Now they've created a new imprint to publish Amazon titles in hardcover and distribute them to physical bookstores around the country, at least the ones that will carry them. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. We look at conflicts of interest all the time between networks and major studios and cable companies. This is just another example where Amazon is, you know, selling books for all the major publishers, but now they're bidding for authors and they're bidding for titles like Laverne, Penny Marshall's memoir, and they're winning and taking that book and putting it out. But then they say, hey, we don't really distribute books, and they partner with a publisher to do it. So it's a crazy world. You can understand why people would be wary. Amazon used to sell their books, and now they're competing with them to publish the authors and get rid of the publishers completely. But for this stage, Houghton Mifflin says, you know what? There's money to be made. They're getting the book. They're going to put it out. We might as well put it out for them and make some of the money.
Well, that sounds all very convoluted and somewhat businessy, kind of like Inside Baseball.
All right. Take us in there.
Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
I love this story.
Yes, I know. I highlighted this story specifically because I knew you would like it. And it's kind of something that we've been talking about over the last several weeks. We had John Fithian on to talk about the health of the theatrical box office and theatrical market for motion pictures. Well, guess what? Mike Masnick over at TechDirt presented a white paper over at MIDIM, which is this kind of an industry conference in Cannes, France. You know where that is, Michael, right? Cannes?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, okay, just checking. Well, it turns out the sky is rising, not falling. The entertainment industry is large and growing, not shrinking, according to Mike Masnick of TechDirt. The overall entertainment ecosystem is in what he calls a real renaissance period. And he highlights it by talking about, he split the report up, first of all, into video and film, books, music, and video games. And all four segments are showing significant growth over the last decade.
Right, exactly. When you look at, that's the fascinating thing. I've always said, if you look at the big pie of what people are spending on, like movies, whether it's theatrical, video on demand, DVD, Blu-ray, cable, you know, pay-per-view, et cetera, that the pie is much bigger than it was a couple decades ago. And I would always argue that one segment helps balance out a loss in another segment. But he's saying, even if you look just at books, you're seeing a lot of growth. If you look just at music, and I assume he's counting, you know, concert sales and things like that, you're seeing growth. So like adults who normally would maybe just buy 4 or 5 albums a year because they're, you know, in their 30s and 40s, they don't buy a lot of albums. Well, they've got satellite radio in their car and they've got Pandora or Spotify on their computer at home. Suddenly they're paying a lot more per month than they would if they just bought 4 or 5 albums. And that means the overall money being spent on music is growing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the key points he raises is exactly that, Michael, that the entertainment industry, or entertainment industry spending, listen to me, entertainment spending by consumers as a function of their income went up by 15% from 2000 to 2008.
So no matter what you make, you're spending like 15% on fun. Going to the movies, buying Blu-rays, listening to music, satellite radio, you name it. Get it. You get an e-reader and you start buying some books on Kindle, stuff like that.
Well, it went up by 15%. So if you were spending 1%, then now you're spending 16% of your income.
No, that would be an increase of 160%.
Well, you know, technically, if you'd like, I could actually do your taxes for you, too.
That would be great.
Yeah.
And the industry as a whole is growing. There's more employment. Employment grew 20%. Depending how you define the entertainment business, with good video games and all that stuff. And, of course, the biggest thing of all, which is not a surprise, it may not be good, but there's a whole lot of content being created. Because now I can make a movie in my backyard and it looks pretty damn good. I can make an album that sounds just as good as people who spend millions of dollars in studios. And that's really no lie.
Yeah. I mean, what he's saying here is that the entertainment industry grew 66% from 1998 to 2010. That's right. The overall outcome there. And I'm sure that there are people, and they'd be right, by the way, to say, yes, well, okay, one... You know, if you take movies, yes, okay, they've all gone up. But, you know, theaters may not be making as much money as video, or vice versa. Video may not be. So, yes, individual sectors within each one of those little.
Maybe up and down.
Maybe up and down. That's very true. However, overall, this is, again, a macro look, not a micro look. The entertainment industry is apparently large and growing.
And that doesn't mean you can be complacent. You have to see where the new growth is happening. You have to be able to adapt and change. But. Be wary of somebody who says, nobody's going to the movies again. Kids are never going to the movies, or nobody's going to read anymore. You know, there's a lot of money to be made and a lot of great content being created. It's easier than ever. Hey, we've got a podcast and we put it out to the world every week and we're doing it out of our homes. So look what's possible.
Oh, speak for yourself. I'm in a studio. Anyway, speaking of reading things, maybe we should read some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, which is our email address. First off, I'd like to thank Walt Milos, who sent me a happy birthday wish. He said that he sent it to me on a Sunday morning, and he said he was walking 11 miles around the Saratoga battlefield listening to Showbiz Sandbox. So, Walt, thank you very much for the birthday wishes and for listening to Showbiz Sandbox.
Is that your birthday or Showbiz Sandbox's birthday?
Well, it was my birthday.
When did I miss it? When was your birthday? Happy birthday.
It was yesterday, January 29th.
I'm a terrible person. I'm traveling all over the country and I miss that. Well, happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. But, you know, to not be a terrible person, you should go to iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, rate and review our podcast there, or send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, just like Greg Bridle from New Zealand did. Do you want to read this, Michael, or do you want me to read it?
I'll be glad to read it. Hi, Sperling and Michael. Just listened to episode 133 and the story on Mega Upload, and I have a few issues with what you discussed. Mega Upload founder Kim.com and his associates were arrested in New Zealand, where he has residency, not Australia, while the company is based out of Hong Kong and some of the servers they used were in the U.S., hence the FBI being involved. However, my big issue is the complete lack of due process involved in the whole thing. As you know, Sperling, this is all happening in my home country, and so I have been following the local news quite closely. The FBI orchestrated this raid with the New Zealand police. which in local speak means they were told to do it. but when Kim.com came up in court in New Zealand, he was denied bail, not because what he had done was illegal, but because he was considered a flight risk. There was not enough proof presented in court to show overwhelming guilt, and this has now become a, quote, trial by media circus. I understood that you were innocent until proven guilty, and yet without due process, the FBI has shut down his business, arrested and incarcerated four men, frozen their assets, and could be party to the loss of private and personal information for a very large number of users. And by personal information, I don't mean pirated MP3s and movies, but personal documents and photos, etc. If they can do this to Mega Upload, then what else can they do it to? In these days of technology, it would not be difficult to add a filter that stops people from downloading the large majority of music and movies from the site while still giving people access to download their own personal information and preventing anyone from uploading anything new. Or, in Mega Upload's case, disabling the file sharing completely, giving the account holders the only access to their data. Giving account holders only access to their own data. I think that's what he means. I read that poorly. The damage that actions like this could have on the whole store your data in the cloud market could be significant. Where's your data safe? If you choose the wrong supplier, do you risk losing your only copy of your wedding photos? I fully support the government shutting down proven sources of pirated material. But throwing the baby out with the bathwater just because you think the bathwater is dirty is not the way forward. The U.S. are now trying to have .com extradited to stand trial, but because copyright infringement is not serious enough to warrant extradition, they have also thrown in conspiracy to commit money laundering and racketeering to boost their odds. Yet they presented no evidence to show his alleged guilt on any of the charges, despite having investigated for over a year. What these people are alleged to have done should be punished if it can be proven in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. When we start forgetting due process, we start to undermine everything that the law stands for.
Yeah, he goes on to say that he's put in a few links here, but I'd have to say that there's a story now that's kind of making a lot of headlines because the FBI has told the data companies, "Oh, you can delete all the data now. Don't worry, we've got what we need out of it. You can delete
to just people who are hosting the servers."
Yes, exactly.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, well, wait a second. If you had arrested somebody for, I don't know, selling crack cocaine, would you say, well, we've arrested them, we've taken pictures of the cocaine, okay, we're going to burn it now before the guy goes to trial? I mean, what if he's found innocent? And so basically you're taking...
Cocaine is not necessarily a very good comparison, is it?
Well, no. Okay, so stolen vehicles or whatever you want to, you know, call it.
But you don't trash them until you know who owns them and whether they're legally obtained material or not.
Right. And so all of these people like you and I who might put a Word document up there or as Greg Bridle...
Which I never have, but we could.
But we could. But, you know, as Greg Bridle points out, what if I put all of the photos, all of my photos from a wedding or, the birth of my daughter's up on these servers, which I now no longer have access to. And now the FBI is saying, hey, just delete everything.
Well, Greg's made a great point. We're always talking about due process. That was the problem with SOPA and PIPA and how those were put forward. You have to make, you can't just say, well, we think they're pirates and therefore we can skip all the little niceties like a trial and just, throw them in jail or shut down their website. As he says, if you were breaking a drug ring, yeah, you arrest the people, you put them in court, they have to go before a judge and all that sort of stuff. So it's not unusual that you would seize assets and lock down a business when you have a, just cause to show that you need to act. You get a warrant, you take action, you make the arrest. But yeah, then you got to prove your case. You can't just destroy all the information, throw them in jail and, do what you want. So Greg makes a great point. Due process seems to always be thrown out the window when it comes to digital stuff. I'm not quite sure why. I think it doesn't seem as serious. And so they don't mind acting more maliciously because it doesn't seem real to them. It's not like seizing a home and burning. You wouldn't torch a home if you see it's a drug lord's home. You would wait and find out the trial and then sell it to pay off his debt or let him reclaim it if he was found innocent, etc.
Exactly. And in this case, you're actually hurting people who were completely innocent of pirating anything.
Right.
And so
one thing is clear. You can use Mega Upload very innocently and legally. You can upload your wedding photos to leave them on that server. So why should you be punished or lose all your stuff?
Yeah, no, I agree. And don't get me started on this. I think that the entertainment industry has lost sight of just how powerful a movement the internet can be. And they learned it with SOPA and PIPA, but
we need to keep learning it.
Yeah, but if they want to vilify Kim.com and Mega Upload, the right thing to do here is to make sure people can have access to the files that they put up there. Maybe not the pirated files if they can actually locate them, but the data that people put in the cloud on those servers that were not illegal, they should have access to. But now, speaking of, you know, I guess maybe we should have started with this this next email, because an underemployed filmmaker, he or she did not leave his or her name, listened to the podcast. I guess it was episode 132 with John Fithian, where we talked about the health of the movie industry. And he says, "Hi, guys, I love the podcast. It's the best source of movie news on the net." Well, thank you very much. "I really got into your debate last week regarding the statistics surrounding the state of the movie industry. Really, the statistics can be read in so many ways depending on which years you decide to look at. You're both completely right, but because I wanted to draw my own conclusions, I'm really thankful you made all of your sources available on your site. I took that info plus some I sourced from other places on the internet and created an infographic. If you like it, please send it around." And we absolutely will. We're going to include it in our show notes. It's an interesting infographic about the state of the movie industry. And I don't know, Michael, if you've had a chance to look at it.
I look forward to it. I've been traveling in the car, so I haven't been. I try not to look at websites while I'm driving.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. You probably also shouldn't text, by the way.
but I look forward to checking out, and thank you very much for sharing it with us. That's a fun thing to do. You get information and then you present a new way that somehow illustrates it better than just text or talking, or, you know, that's the power of the internet. You get that raw info and you can create your own graphic to show it in a new way.
I mean, yeah, he even goes into, like, how much leisure time he or she, again, I don't know, you know, gender here, but how much leisure time, most Americans have, 5.18 hours.
Well, let's not take up any more of theirs, since we already take up at least 1.5 hours of that. So maybe we should wind it up.
Yes, indeed. And actually, again, you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Zoom Marketplace, Stitcher, an RSS reader, your favorite podcatcher. Please do rate us in some of those places. Rate, review our podcast. We'd really appreciate it. It does help us out. Links to all the stories that we've discussed, including underemployed filmmakers infographic, that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Our website is not only where you'll find ways to subscribe and all of our contact info and links to all the stories, but also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Twitter, our username is showbizsandbox. And guess what? Facebook, it's the same thing, Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. And Michael, do you want to tell everybody what it is?
MichaelGiltz.com.
Indeed. Now, I'd like to thank Michael Tuckman from M. Tuckman Media for joining us earlier in the show. I have a website where you can find some of my writing, celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.